All knowledge is metaphorical in nature. That is, when we see or experience something unfamiliar, we seek out a metaphor, some kind of prior experience that is familiar to us, and we apply it to that new thing as a way to try to make sense of it. So understanding and knowledge, I believe, essentially is an act of making the unfamiliar more familiar by tying it to something we already know and understand. And to the extent that that metaphor works, that's to the extent that we understand the new phenomenon.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is Season 2, Episode 1 of Damn the Absolute. I am happy to be back with you, following a few-month break and a few thousand-mile move from Cascadia to southern Appalachia. We are now recording Damn the Absolute from the Blue Ridge Mountains, a new bioregion, but the same mission. In hopes of making Charles Sanders Peirce proud, we'll continue doing our damnedest not to block the path of inquiry. This season, we'll further explore democracy, epistemology, pluralism, community, permaculture, and all sorts of fruitful ideas. You can look forward to more episodes on Richard Rorty and William James, amongst other pragmatist philosophers, philosophy of mind, psychoanalysis, and the importance of place. We're covering a lot of different ground, talking with a diverse group of people. I hope you'll stay with us throughout the entire season and that you'll find some ideas worth experimenting with. Enjoy. Scientific inquiry is sometimes viewed as a way of getting after literal knowledge, the belief our scientific claims are a one-for-one match with reality, or what is actually happening out there in the world. However, this view requires a certainty in our beliefs or truth claims about nature that may not be justified. Furthermore, this absoluteness may lead us toward a scientism that runs counter to the openness and dynamism that animate so much of what scientists practice in their labs, fieldwork, empirical research, and daily lives. Alternatively, other scientists and philosophers frame scientific knowledge as metaphorical. Mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell, for example. Scientific claims require storytelling components and familiar imagery to help us understand what's happening at any given moment. Scientific metaphors are valid only as much as they are useful in addressing problems in our lived environments, or providing a reliable means for predicting future events. Jessica Wauman is the author of Narrative Naturalism, an Alternative Framework for Philosophy of Mind, and co-editor of Cosmopolitanism and Place. She researches and publishes on topics in American philosophy, particularly the work of George Santayana and philosophical psychology. Her current research focuses on pragmatic conceptions of the self and their implications for debates about free will. She's also a senior lecturer in philosophy at Emory University. Wauman believes that viewing scientific knowledge as metaphorical creates not only a more fruitful approach to science, but avoids the many missteps and dogmatism that often attend more literalist ways of investigating nature and experience. This metaphorical thinking informs what she calls narrative naturalism, a non-reductive but naturalistic method for studying our world and the way things work, specifically consciousness and the questions of the mind. Now, a few things to consider. If scientific knowledge is metaphorical, why not settle for more mythological explanations rather than material or naturalistic ones? Why should we be careful about reducing feelings or thoughts to mere brain chemistry? And what concrete impact in our daily lives can a narrative naturalist approach have? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
We like to start with a moment of doubting. What is a viewpoint you've held as an adult you were confident wouldn't change that's actually shifted dramatically?
That's a really good question, and I'm going to give probably a frustrating answer. I can't think of one, not because I've never changed my mind, but because I don't know if that I ever had confidence that a view I held couldn't change. There's nothing where I thought like, well, this won't change. This is something I will believe from here on out, because somehow in principle, it always seemed like, well, any new thing could happen to show that I'm wrong. It's not to say that there haven't been things that surprised me or that never occurred to me to doubt before, but I don't know that there's anything that I thought like, yep, this one's good for all time or for my life.
Would you be able to pinpoint, it sounds like maybe somebody earlier in life just gifted you what I think is a wonderful mindset. Is it possible to pinpoint where some of those ideas came for you of being able to acknowledge my ideas are likely to change? I'm not going to hold too firmly to these.
I don't know exactly where it came from. The best I can imagine is that I grew up in two very different places at once. I grew up in New York City, and we spent summers in rural Michigan. And we went back and forth, and my parents were always sort of explaining different people have different lifestyles, think different ways, experience things differently. I think I just sort of experienced interpretations of society and life and reality as relative and as dependent on people's experience and upbringings. That certainly in terms of religion, it was explained to me that lots of people had different sorts of beliefs. And when I grew up, I might decide to choose one of those beliefs, but I might not. I think what was also interesting is I only found out much later that both my parents had studied philosophy as undergrads, which I did not know until much later. So perhaps through osmosis, I sort of developed this attitude, but I'm really not sure.
Well, bless your parents for that. Let's start with some philosophy, lay some groundwork for our conversation. Some people view philosophy as a way of arriving at truth through reason, and perhaps there's some blend of evidence or justification in there. But you like to view philosophy as a kind of dramatic storytelling. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that I believe all explanatory practices have a storytelling component. So I want to stress that I don't believe that storytelling is bereft of reason or evidence, and I don't believe reasoning and evidence is bereft of storytelling. I believe these two things overlap a great deal. And then philosophy in particular, given its subject matter, which really is wisdom about the very meaning of life. What is truth? What is the good? How ought we to live our lives? How ought we to construct just societies? These are not just data points. These are important stories that we have to tell ourselves and each other to make life meaningful.
I appreciate that. I think in the history of philosophy, there has been a strong pushback against narrative, isn't there?
Yes, that's absolutely right. For a very long time, it goes back to Plato at the very least, and his famous rejection or ejection of the poets from his just society, his perfect ideal society that he called the Kallipolis. The point was that the poets were sparking human emotions. They were getting people all riled up to go to war or to hate certain people. And they weren't critically investigating why they believed what they did. And so Plato's Socrates saw the poets as inciting emotion without critical reflection. And this was a danger to the society. And certainly, this is very important. We need critical reflection. It's just that I don't think there's the same kind of opposition between poetry and reason and information seeking as philosophers have historically made it out to be. We need poets and we need critical thinkers, and we need sometimes them to be the same people.
Wonderful. You mentioned this with your parents' views a little bit, offering some pluralism here. There's certainly a pluralistic approach you take in philosophy that shows up in your views on philosophy of mind, which you've written a lot about. And when you present your views on philosophy of mind, you present it as a single view rather than as the right, quote unquote, the right view of philosophy of mind. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. I have a hard time imagining what a correct view of philosophy of mind would even be, given the subject matter. even the most stable forms of knowledge I think we've enjoyed in the sciences, the various paradigms of physics, have changed over time as new evidence has come along. So it's hard to imagine there could be a timeless, singular, and correct philosophy of mind. At the same time, I think some versions or visions of philosophy of mind are more encompassing. They account for more aspects of the problem without leaving something out or making it unreal or insignificant. And I tend to prefer those kinds. That said, I don't think that the way in which I've chosen to tell this story and the terms I've chosen to use are necessarily the terms that will resonate best for everyone. And so there will be other versions that are encompassing, that make some place for conscious life in what I think of as a material world or an experiential world, for those who don't like the term material. So there would be an example. Those could all be equally good ways of telling the story of the mind-body problem, of how conscious life and physical reality can go together.
So we're going to start going down this scientific inquiry road. But before we do, I want to give our audience a couple more tools to use. These are going to be really big terms, although for most people, they're very common sense terms, and we kind of intuit them and think, well, these are mundane terms. But how might you describe or define experience and nature? Because you talked about being your philosophy or view on philosophy being very experimental or experiential.
Yeah, that's a great question. And those, I think, are frequently words that we don't set about defining. And I'm actually would be very happy not to define in the philosopher's mode of coming up with necessary and sufficient conditions. I'm not going to say this
Wonderful.
Is exactly experience. This is exactly nature. That's not going to, I don't know how that's possible. But by experience, I guess I just mean that which human beings and probably other animals undergo in their conscious lives. It's information and feelings that result from their interactions with the physical world, from their own state of their own bodies. And nature is even more, I think, imprecise, because nature philosophically has meant everything from physical stuff to, as Ralph Waldo Emerson referred to it, the face of spirit, right? So that's a big difference. But what I mean, or what I mean when I use the term nature, is something like the entire expanse of existence existing in some kind of continuity. That is, there's nothing supernatural. Anything that would not be continuous with existence in the mundane, everyday way we know it would be somehow supernatural. So as a naturalist, I think of nature as all there is, and everything is natural in a very broad sense. For those people who know who Spinoza is, it's sort of a Spinozistic notion of nature. Nature is absolutely infinite substance. Whatever substance is, that's another question. But right, it's absolutely infinite everything. Nature is everything that we encounter, and it is it's not isolated into chunks. It is somehow continuous in whatever it is. So it's a very vague answer, which makes you perhaps realize why I like stories about things, because it's a very hard thing to capture in the definition.
There's a word you mentioned there that I latch on to, continuous, which some people might hear that and think a very orderly universe, maybe like a machine or clockwork. Is that a metaphor that you resonate with when you're talking about the word nature, or are you going to push back against that?
I'm going to partially resonate with it and partially push back against it. And I really want to stress both, because I think it's so easy for philosophers to get into these sorts of intramural debates about things like this. And it's like, mechanistic materialism isn't bad. And the alternative isn't, I don't think, the right one. Mechanistic explanation has gotten us really far in a lot of ways. You couldn't design and fly an airplane or go to space, like we seem to be doing again with civilians, without mechanistic interpretations of nature. But the idea that somehow the mechanistic metaphor has captured the essential nature of existence itself, I think, is overblown and leads to problems when non-mechanistic solutions may be in order. And an example for this might be something like issues of environmentalism and climate change. Mm-hmm. Something like a notion of an interdependent system might help us to understand the ways in which different life forms depend on each other in their environment, make an environment sustainable and thrive, or otherwise undermine an environment. Whereas the notion of a bunch of parts interlocking and interacting, such as a machine metaphor would suggest, won't tell the story as well and might not help us come up with solutions to, say, a given environmental problem.
Yeah, leaning into that example you're bringing up, I think of describing an ecosystem in very mechanistic terms can often miss the dynamism and the flow and flux of everything.
Yes, the dynamism is a nice way of putting it. And also the interdependence, I think, in the dynamism. Certainly interlocking parts in a machine are important. But when we think of how to fix a machine, you just take a part out and put in a new part that works and, hey, the machine is up and running again.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work as well in terms of life. We can certainly do amazing things with replacing parts in human beings and animals more than we used to. But there's a way in which you do that enough and the system just isn't going to function. And eventually the life is going to dissipate and the organism's not going to be alive anymore. So an organism and a machine have overlapping aspects, but they're very different interpretations of what some kind of material system is doing. There are different ways of understanding whatever it is that's going on.
We talked about a couple of metaphors here, the machine or a machine. And metaphor is very important in your view on what you call narrative naturalism. And when we talk about scientific knowledge, it's common for us to act like the claims we make are literal. For example, the earth literally rotates around the sun, or water literally consists of H2O. But you argue that knowledge is metaphorical or literary rather than literal. Could you walk us through that a little bit more?
Yeah. And to be honest, this one is entirely indebted to a psychologist who wrote a very interesting book called The Origin of Consciousness and the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. His name was Julian Jaynes. And leaving his main thesis aside, what he established in the beginning of the book was the extent to which all knowledge is metaphorical in nature. That is, when we see or experience something unfamiliar, we seek out a metaphor, some kind of prior experience that is familiar to us, and we apply it to that new thing as a way to try to make sense of it. So understanding and knowledge, I believe, essentially is an act of making the unfamiliar more familiar by tying it to something we already know and understand. And to the extent that that metaphor works, that's to the extent that we understand the new phenomenon. One example that he uses that I think is helpful is Niels Bohr's solar system model of the atom, with the idea that the electrons are like little planets orbiting the sun that is the nucleus. And there's all kinds of limitations to that metaphor, right? As we've found out, electrons behave in very interesting ways, and they definitely don't behave like planets. They don't revolve around a nucleus as some kind of like stable, independent entity. Right? And we found that whole problem with when you try to measure them, you can measure one feature or another feature, but you can't say where an electron is until it collapses into a space when you measure it. So that's just all to say it was a really helpful way at the time of thinking about what an atom might be. And it helped to make whatever data scientists were discovering coherent to them. But of course, it was metaphorical. And there's lots of ways in which an atom differs from a solar system.
To hopefully not beat a dead horse here, when I say an apple is red because light waves touch my retina, that to me, or to many of us, feels literal, but that's also metaphorical, right?
Yeah. In fact, I think if we look at that phrase, right, light waves touch my retina, I think for those of us who are not neuroscientists or physicists, we're imagining somehow a beam sort of hitting our eye, physically touching it, and then magically the color red appears in our head. So leaving out the optic nerve in the occipital lobe of the brain, we have a notion of a light wave touching the retina of our eye that is already metaphorical, because I'm going to be out of my depth if I get too much into photons and the physics of photons, but they're known to behave as a particle and a wave depending on the experimental constraints. So is it a particle hitting your retina? Is it a wave undulating up to your retina and touching it? These are very metaphorical images, and it's certainly not going to be anything, the kind of stimulation between photons and the rods and cones in the retina of the eye. It's not going to be anything like we think of when we think of human touch. But we use that to try to understand and to form an image in our minds of what it is that's going on.
This notion that scientific facts are metaphorical rather than a one-for-one description of reality or nature, etc., is troubling for some people who will hold to it as a literal description of what's going on. What words of comfort do you have for those people? Why should they not be bothered by scientific knowledge being metaphorical rather than literal?
I think, yes, you're right. There are going to be people that are very bothered by it, and this may not comfort everyone. But I think if we recognize the metaphorical aspects in scientific theories, we understand the creativity that goes into science, how this isn't simply a bare recording of what is, but is rather a massively creative and ingenious endeavor, and ultimately the theory itself and a creative artifact. And it also gives us recourse when we seem to hit roadblocks in our inquiry, because it may be the case in some cases that the theory isn't working anymore, that some new piece of information is hitting right up against a stale theory. And we now have the freedom to critically examine that metaphor or that story we've been telling and see where we might imagine things differently. So in many ways, it's extremely empowering, I think, to recognize the creative and more metaphorical aspects of knowledge.
Whatever the phenomena we're trying to explain, there are a lot of metaphors we can reach for to help us understand it. If knowledge is metaphorical, how do we know which of our metaphors either corresponds better with reality or is maybe most useful for coping with that reality?
Well, this is where I expose myself as a pragmatist for sure. And one of the things I love about the pragmatist that I think so many people don't recognize is how influenced their theory was by scientific practice. So if you think about how science actually works, it's not some sort of transcendence of human experience to go, hey, God, what's really going on? Of course not. That's not what happens at all. Rather, scientists formulate a question, right? They ask a question and they think of how they're going to ask a question of nature, to be metaphorical about it. And they construct an experiment designed to get a response from nature. That's the data. And then they interpret the data. And insofar as the data accounts well for, insofar as the explanation accounts well for the data observed and successfully predicts new experience in the future, I believe that is what counts as a true theory. So there is no other test that I know of for a true theory besides its confirmation and experience.
I think you've just answered this question in part, but I want to ask it just to upset scientists and mythologists at the same time. But if our scientific knowledge is metaphorical and mythology is full of metaphors, why do we not settle more often for mythological explanations rather than material or more naturalistic ones?
Well, I would actually say that a lot of people do settle for more mythological explanations because quite frequently they can be far more comforting than scientific explanations. But I don't think yours is ultimately a psychological question. You're not asking me why people do, but why ought we to, I think, not settle for mythological explanations when we're trying to come up with a scientific understanding of a problem. I think sometimes mythological explanations, if they're comforting and they don't hurt anybody, you know, I talk about the gods all the time. I don't literally believe that there are gods, but I'll sometimes say, like, you know, God's willing, this will all happen. But I think, again, what you're suggesting is that just because there are lots of stories doesn't make all stories equally good at understanding experience and making sense of experience. And I think if we're dealing with something like climate change, sacrificing a bunch of cattle to Zeus is not going to make a big difference in lessening hurricanes, cooling the planet, lessening forest fires, and so on. Precisely because, again, there's not a way in which we have asked a question of nature and gotten a reliable confirmation back that Zeus's anger is the cause of climate change. And similarly, thoughts and prayers have turned out to be very bad ways of controlling climate change and gun violence and all sorts of other phenomena that we would love to change just by praying for it to go away. So while there might be some benefits to prayer and even offerings to the gods, if we're talking about scientific knowledge, which aims at both predicting and controlling future experience, then those stories aren't going to work as well unless they enable us to do that.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here, doing that podcaster thing and inviting you to rate and review Damn the Absolute wherever you listen to podcasts. It means a lot to me and the editorial team at Eradicus, who produces the podcast. Plus, it helps us continue bringing you meaningful conversations around fruitful ideas. Enjoy the rest of the show. I want to use a metaphor, step into a few scientific fields here and get at some more particulars. I'm thinking about neuroscience. It is not uncommon among neuroscientists to look at a brain scan and to then see the brain scan as totally explanatory of a wide variety of human experiences or emotions. They'll look at a brain scan and go, see, that's really what anger is. It's right there. It's these things going on here that I can see. Or, well, self-esteem is actually what's going on here. For example, why should we be careful about reducing our feelings to mere brain chemistry, for example?
Well, before I answer the second part of the main part of the question, I do want to give props to the neuroscientists because I sometimes think they're better at this than the philosophers or the journalists or the everyday public. They, when they're engaged in their scientific activities, they usually refer to this stuff as the neural correlate of some kind of experience. Mm-hmm. So they're often saying, look, it's not our scientific endeavor to test how it is that some neurological phenomenon gives rise to subjective experience. That's outside the range of their empirical purview. So they say this is the neural correlate of what's going on. But it's either the journalists that want to scare the crap out of people, in all honesty, by having, like, you know, your brain on in three colors. And, you know, this is the fMRI that shows exactly where your fear and anger are. Or you have philosophers that very much want to make sure everything is scientifically explicable in their version of that, which I think sometimes has very little to do with science, actually. And they say, look, we finally figured out what thoughts and feelings are. They're this fMRI scan. And what's wrong with that is, of course, they're not an fMRI scan because an fMRI scan is a model. It's a model that has picked out certain aspects of neurological behavior and has done this repeatedly. It's repeatedly scanning brain activity and then presenting, again, I'm going to hit the limits of my knowledge of the details, but what it actually presents is a correction, something that corrects for variation in what it's recorded. So what you've got in any kind of brain scan, whether it's an fMRI or something else, is some kind of model, something that the designer has created to pick out certain features of a natural experience as a way, again, of anticipating what might be going on in general when some kind of conscious experience takes place. And so we say, the amygdala lights up when presented with a fearful situation. It also lights up, apparently, when people who are known to be racist are confronted with situations where they're supposed to decide whether a person of a different race is frightening. So by itself, that doesn't tell you too much about whether somebody is a racist or about whether something ought to be frightening. It just says when you're scared or excited or whatever, this aspect of the brain seems to be involved in that. And so there's a difference between saying we've figured out the aspect of the brain that appears to be responsible for these sorts of experiences, for creating these sorts of experiences, but that doesn't really explain why certain things are frightening or why people are racist or why people have unconscious bias, right? We actually need a correlate between the neuroscientific information and some kind of psychological, sociological, or just everyday human experience information about what life is like to even make sense out of the neurological information. So it can't just be the neurology because the neurology is only part of the story.
Following your lead, I'm going to be careful not to just put this on psychiatrists and medical experts or even materialists, but there is a common story when speaking about depression, anxiety, or other emotional states, that those emotional states are caused by physiology or biology. And this is getting at the why, which you're trying to kind of avoid. And this is part of why psychiatrists do prescribe SSRIs, expecting that they will improve someone's emotional state. What is missing in this story? Or why should we be careful about latching too firmly onto that explanation?
I remember in the early 90s when Prozac first came on the scene, and the great excitement was that we finally realized that depression is just an issue of serotonin reuptake or serotonin production. And what we need to do is block the reuptake of serotonin, and then depressed people won't be depressed anymore. And of course, in the intervening, 20 years or so, we've realized that it's just not that simple. So from a practical aspect, I think anybody who's been familiar with people experiencing depression and taking medication, this is not a simple fix. Usually people have to experiment with which kinds of medications work. Some do, some don't. There are some theories that it's not serotonin reuptake, that SSRIs are not necessarily the best solution to the problem of depression. And I think what's behind that is at least twofold. One, the very theory itself was largely symptom driven. We like to imagine, I think, in everyday life that scientists somehow stuck a brain under a microscope and said, oh, look, there's no serotonin there. That's the problem. Let's give them an SSRI. But that's not what happened at all. I don't even know how you'd begin to stick a living brain under a microscope. But that's sort of the imaginary thing that the everyday person thinks of. Like, they saw it. They saw there wasn't any serotonin, and they made the brain have more. And then we aren't depressed anymore. But so there's that. And then secondarily, all that we're realizing when we realize it, and it is important to recognize that this may be some partial aspect of explaining depression, that again, doesn't necessarily tell us why a person is depressed. That says this is what's going on in the brain when a person is depressed. And there may be a wide range of explanations for why a given individual is depressed. And in some cases, it really may be something that is so systemic to the organism that no matter what you do experientially, the brain is going to have a very hard time maintaining itself. And so in some cases, maybe medication really is an absolutely necessary aspect. In other cases, it may be that something experientially traumatic has affected someone's system. And this might be a temporary help, but that hardly accounts for the environmental aspects and the experiential aspects that may have led to the person's depression in the first place. We're highly complex systems is what I'm trying to get at. And so reducing this to a problem in the machine, namely, hey, there's not enough serotonin in the synapses, oversimplifies a problem that has social aspects, psychological aspects, aspects having to do with self-understanding and self-knowledge. And so the last point I'd like to make is that the mechanistic story, when it's treated as exhaustive, can actually be counterproductive to therapy because it affects a client's self-understanding. If they understand themselves as helpless insofar as their machine is broken and they just have to take a pill to fix it, and then the pill doesn't fix it, so now they must be really broken and there's nothing they can do about it in terms of thinking differently about their life, about the way in which they solve interpersonal problems, the whole host of things that a psychotherapist might address in addition to sometimes prescribing medication, right? So the stories that the therapist and the client themselves tell about why they're depressed can actually be significant to the healing process.
There are some who will hear your explanation here and push back and say, well, we may not right now have the technology to put the brain under a scan and to see the serotonin and look at it and connect it in this way, or be like, oh, see, I can connect this exact thought process to this chain of chemicals going on in the brain, something like that. How realistic do you think it is that we could at some point develop a technology that's able to reveal that?
Well, this sort of gets back to your first question. I'm going to expose myself again as saying, like, hey, I don't know. I'm open to the possibility that this is achievable. I'm not going to say, nope, in principle, that's impossible. There's no way we're ever going to be able to read minds with technology, especially because I've read some cases where there have been, at least in general senses, abilities to predict what a person is thinking in better than random averages. So there's ways in general that some experimenters have been able to predict, anticipate, or accurately identify some thought process or feeling that the subject was undergoing. So they are, to some extent, it's already happening. But if we think about what actually would be involved in linking up a very specific thought with a brain scan, let's say I'm thinking about a truck, would we have to then have the truck aspect of the brain be nearly identical in every person for us to be able to generalize that this is where trucks occur? This seems unlikely to me just because human experience is so associative. And so whatever memories I have about trucks and associations I have about trucks are probably realized in my brain in different ways than somebody else, like maybe who goes to monster truck rallies, right, thinks about trucks. It's not that there won't be some similarities and some overlap, but as even many neuroscientists have pointed out, there's so much individual variation in the connections among neurons because of individual experiences. Even identical twins, once they've been alive for any period of time, no longer, they can't be said to have identical brains because they've had different experiences. And so the synaptic connections that are reinforced and strengthened are not going to be identical. So it's hard for me to imagine, not to say I think it's impossible, but it's hard for me to imagine how we'd be able to literally read every thought. And then finally, even if we were doing that, we have to notice that would depend on correlations between reports of subjective experiences by prior people. So there's no way in which this takes subjective experience out of the problem. The only way I would know that somebody in the future is thinking about a truck is that somehow in the past, somebody had correlated a set of subjects going, I'm thinking about a truck, with some kind of brain scan, some kind of measuring device. So there's always going to be this issue of having some kind of subjective experience or reported experience experimentally lined up with some kind of brain scan. And I don't know how you overcome that aspect to say that it's really just one or it's really just the other, but I'm not close to the possibility.
I appreciate the open-mindedness. I will not force you to prognosticate on any other points here. We've skirted around consciousness a little bit, but I want to, as it were, try and hit the nail on the head or focus a little bit more in on that. You have a view of consciousness that you argue is non-reductive. What do you find are some reductive views or mainstream views of consciousness that can be a bit reductive?
Well, one of the ones I believe we've already touched on is the idea that because there is some brain activity correlated with conscious experience, that the conscious experience as a natural event has been exhaustively explained by the neuroscientific account. I see no reason why that should be an exhaustive explanation of what a conscious event is, even in a natural sense, because you're left with the question of what are the conditions that are sufficient in a neurological event to produce subjective experience, or as philosophers of mind like to call it, the what it's like aspect of consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. Not just that I may be seeing red, but there's some qualitative aspect that it's like for me when I see a red rose or look at a fire truck. I have trucks on the brain for some reason. I don't know why.
So you're talking about here qualia, the philosophical term, you know, what it is like to be something. On this podcast, we've talked about Nagel's What It's Like to Be a Bat, which is a fascinating perspective to take. There's some who will try and take a naturalist approach of not quite reducing the mind to the brain and just saying that's just what your mind is, but take an emergentist view that It's not just the brain, but it emerges from the brain. That's your mind. What do you find problematic about that view?
I like emergentism better than the more reductive options. My quibble with emergentism is slightly technical, but I don't think too technical. I think what happens when we think of consciousness as an emergent property of the brain is that we treat it like a property. We treat it as something that can be studied in addition to the brain activity. And consciousness is, as I understand it, subjective awareness itself. It's aware of qualia. So I wanted to make a distinction between consciousness and the various qualities and characteristics of which I am aware as a conscious entity, or in a conscious event, there are qualia, loosely speaking, but those qualia are not my consciousness. They're the objects of my consciousness. So this has been taken up by several philosophers, as varying as my favorite philosopher, George Santayana, the naturalist, but also by the existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre, who tries to stress how consciousness is nothingness. Consciousness is always of something, but consciousness is not a thing we can study. I don't know how we would make consciousness itself into a scientific object to study. And so emergentism sometimes, understandably, tries to talk about consciousness as a property that arises when matter takes on a certain kind of configuration, namely a living, active brain. But unlike something like surface tension in water, which is an emergent property of water molecules, one water molecule doesn't have surface tension, but water, lots of water molecules do. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how we can observe consciousness as an emergent property except through the reports of conscious beings. So I just don't think it's an empirical phenomenon. It's what makes empirical phenomena possible.
I'm not going to have you sort of go through all the big theories out there, but I want to throw one more out there just to get your sense of it, because it's kind of in vogue right now, at least in discussion, especially among philosophers online, and that is panpsychism. What do you find fruitful in that view? What do you find not so helpful or misguided?
I think panpsychism is interesting. I see nothing in principle to rule it out. In fact, I mentioned Spinoza earlier in our discussion, and I like Spinoza a lot. And he was in a way a panpsychist. I don't want to quibble with Spinozists out there, but he certainly thought that thought and extended substance were in everything, right? God was both thought and thinking and extended. And I always try to get my undergraduates to imagine the chair they're thinking in, the chair they're sitting in as being a thinking entity, right? As also undergoing thought. I have a hard time imagining that myself, but I see nothing in principle to rule it out. The only weakness I guess I see in panpsychism is that it, as a pragmatist, I don't see evidentiary support for it. There's a lot of reason, I think, to believe that many animals experience conscious, subjective lives, suffer pain, experience joy. But I have a harder time imagining anything comparable going on with a rock or a chair. To the extent that it is, it would have to be extremely simplistic and mundane and almost like a being in a stupor, as another philosopher, Leibniz, put it. He said, the simplest souls are in a stupor. They're not really aware of their own, right, of their own conscious life, to sort of paraphrase Leibniz very loosely. So, you know, I think like, okay, if you're invested in panpsychism, I'm not going to say that's impossible, but I just don't see the benefit, the pragmatic benefit of attributing consciousness to things that don't seem to provide evidence that they are sentient in the way that ethically matters to us. Whereas with animals, it does matter. Right? Whether animals suffer matters to things like factory farming, to how we treat them, how we think about their lives and the end of their life and so on. I'm not as concerned about when I turn off my computer at night and when I get rid of it, when it no longer works, that I've somehow wronged it. And so that's the limit of panpsychism for me. I just don't see the evidence that in the way in which I think of myself as conscious and animals as conscious, I don't see evidence that inanimate objects are conscious.
In the most simple language, I know this is difficult as a philosopher, I apologize. But in the most simple terms, how would you articulate a narrative naturalist view of consciousness? How do you understand it?
I think the best way I could address that is to say something about what I mean by narrative naturalism, which is, again, assuming that naturalism is a philosophical viewpoint rather than a scientific viewpoint. It's a philosophical worldview. And what I'm trying to say is that any philosophical account of nature, as much as, if not more than any other kind of explanation, is going to have these literary storytelling elements. And so in telling a story about nature, or for me, all of reality, it makes no sense to me to exclude conscious life when conscious life is essential to telling the story and to caring about what reality is in the first place. So my narrative naturalistic account is largely, again, metaphorical and poetic in nature, but it sees consciousness as an aspect of natural life that is not exhaustively explained by relevant material events, but is nonetheless produced by them, for one, in a very loose sense, produced by them, generated by them.
I want to wrap up here, running out of some time. For some people, many of these issues you've raised may feel a little bit more like philosopher's squabbles, that they're maybe a little too detached from daily life, which that's totally fair. That is true for a lot of people. However, what concrete impact in our daily lives, and you've mentioned a few already, but I want to give you a chance to offer a few more. What are some ways in which narrative naturalism as an approach can impact our daily lives? What are the practical consequences that it may have for some of us?
I think it enriches the possibilities of stories we tell about ourselves. It makes room for the scientific stories. It's not anti-scientific by any stretch. So the scientific discoveries we make that help us to live better lives and understand ourselves better are part of the bigger story and part of the bigger picture and should be included. But to the extent that we despair that that's all the story is, and that some of the richest and most subjective, for want of a better word, aspects of our lives, that is our non-neurological underpinnings, the stuff that often is most meaningful to us in our lives, our love of our families, our worry about our society and what democracy means and what the possibility of living together is and how to make sense out of people from very different backgrounds living together in harmony. These are things that people care about. So how can we include both the scientific accounts that sometimes threaten to make that all seem superficial, imaginary, and unreal? And how can we take those accounts, acknowledge their worth, and at the same time put them in a context of what makes life meaningful to us, at the same time as we put what makes life meaningful to us in a context of scientific stories? So I just see it as enriching the possibilities of making sense of our lives and our world and living well together.
Jessica, thank you so much for elevating narrative, metaphor. I deeply appreciate that and wish you the best of luck in your next endeavor.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to Damn the Absolute. I want to show some love to those of you who have recently been talking about Eradicus and Damn the Absolute online, specifically on Twitter. Thanks to Finn Janning, Vayfarer, Sam Wolf, and Rizoma Field School. Tweet at us at Eradicus Mag or me, Jeffrey_Howard_. Pester us with some of your favorite quotes from Damn the Absolute guests or pitch us on some episode ideas. And again, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really goes a long way in helping us foster a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you all next time.